Welcome to another episode of Living Downstream. My name is Ryan, and I'm the Director of Education and Outreach for the organization Umpqua Watersheds. In this episode, we'll hear from wildlife biologist and author Marcy Cottrell Houle as she reflects on some of the books she's written and the animals and places that inspired them. From there, we'll move on to an interview with Beverly Paulson, longtime member of the Friends of Crater Lake. She'll tell us about some of the many interesting activities going on at Crater Lake and the importance of protecting this magnificent place. First, let's take a moment to pause for land acknowledgement, to remember that various Indigenous groups once tended the lands and waters of the Umpqua watershed, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquel, Malala, and others. It's important to know who and what came before. Their history is part of the story. Our guest on the show today is Marcy Cottrell Houle, a wildlife biologist and author who lives near Portland, Oregon. Marcy, I noticed on your website that you've written several books that relate to nature or the environment. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about how you choose the topics for your books?
Well, I think actually the real answer to that is the topics choose me. I've been very fortunate as a wildlife biologist and an author, but especially with the research projects I've been involved with, to give me some really exciting things to write about. For example, ranging from studying endangered species to studying the densest concentrations of hawks in North America to one of the world's largest urban parks. It's also a wilderness park. And studying generous nature, I got a chance to interview people who have done so much to give me the things I cherish about Oregon. So I have been very fortunate.
Yeah. And so you mentioned being a wildlife biologist. I've interviewed a couple of wildlife biologists for the show, and I'm just wondering what your work entails. You mentioned a little bit, but if you could go into more detail, that'd be great.
Sure. Well, first of all, I always knew I wanted to be a writer, just backing up a little bit, but I also knew I'd love nature and wanted to study it and be a scientist. So I've been very lucky because I've been able to combine the two things I love most of all. And I think for both, but especially going back to your question about being a wildlife biologist, you have to be an observer and be curious. I think those are two major things. And also for me, it was, I loved nature and I love science and I love the art and the beauty of nature and also trying to figure out answers to questions that I thought were really important.
That's great. Yeah, I've had a lot of people on the show who've expressed that, you know, they enjoyed something about either science or nature, the environment, that type of thing when they were younger. And as makes sense, that kind of propelled them into the life they lead now. But yeah, no, I love the combination of, you know, science or nature activities and writing. I also am interested in being an author and I'm brainstorming some ideas for books. So it's always exciting to have an author on the show. I'd love to hear more about each of your books. Can you share a summary of each of them?
Let's see. Yeah, sure. Well, Wings for My Flight, that was one of my earliest books, and it had to do with the time I lived in the wilds of Colorado, in southwestern Colorado. And I was studying at that time, I was really like 21-year-old woman wildlife biologist, and there weren't there many girl wildlife biologists at that time, and studying one of the last 10 of 10 nesting pairs of peregrine falcons left in the United States. So it was a really fascinating project, but it was bittersweet because it really looked at that time that this species would go extinct. So what could I do to save them? So that's kind of that story. Prairie Keepers, Secrets of the Zumwalt. Again, that was a very remote, beautiful part of northeastern Oregon. And it's I was studying the birds and one of the last native prairies remaining in the West. And I discovered from the research the densest concentration of what they call buteo hawks, the big wide-winged hawks in North America. But what's interesting, they weren't happening in a national park. They were happening on private ranch land. So people were part of the equation. So then the question was, how do people and this tremendous wildlife sanctuary coexist? One City's Wilderness. That's been fun. I had a job for 2 years studying Portland's Forest Park, which is one of the largest urban parks actually in the world at over 5,000 acres, but it also is the only designated wilderness city park in the country. And just realized that there were hundreds of different birds and mammals and native wildlife and just a wealth of these species. So then my question became, how do you get people to appreciate how incredibly special this place is? So Generous Nature, that was the most recent book that came out. And again, those are stories of around 20, 21 conservationists who gave so much in terms of in Oregon, the places we love, the legislation we love, the environmental ethic. And I learned how much by interviewing them, how an individual can make such a difference. And so I have other books too, but those are the main things having to do with nature and trying to discover things like, why did these things work so well?
Thank you for sharing that. I have some specific questions about each of your books, I think, now. So you mentioned Wings for My Flight. I recently read a book by Barbara Kingsolver. I'm trying to think, it might've been called Flight Behavior. Mm-hmm. And that had to do with, it was a fictional story, but realistic fiction, and had to do with the scientist who was studying a type of butterfly that was going extinct. But just thinking about the impact on the people who study the wildlife as it's dying out, right? I've always wondered about that. You know, I've researched this kind of porpoise called the vaquita down in the Gulf of Mexico. Like I was doing a project with my students a number of years ago. And at the time, I think there were 200 left. And then I looked it up recently and there were eight left of this species. And it's just incredible in a horrible way, right? Just so traumatic for people who are really close to that species. And I guess what was the impact on you? Have those peregrine falcons bounced back at all? What's the result been?
Those are really good questions, and they do lead up to absolutely the present. I'll go back to when I was first studying them. It was really discouraging. The Endangered Species Act, our most important, really, environmental legislation ever, had been enacted. Peregrines were put on the Endangered Species Act as an endangered species. And then it just went down from there. You'd see these nests and the birds would sit on a nest and break their eggs. So it had to do with thinning eggshells with DDT. So one after another, places that had been nesting sites were just disappearing. So I felt very lucky and challenged to try to study one of the last successful nesting pairs. And the story goes on from there. It really was discouraging. And as you, if you read the book, you realize that someone came and shot and killed the female, and which meant we could have lost that. It was terrible. But the male who they mate for life took over, and as a single dad, tried to raise his young who were successful. I think what it showed me was that I got more and more of a passion. These animals were spectacular. They're the fastest creatures in existence. They can fly over 200 miles per hour in a stoop, as they call it, in a dive. And I thought, you know, these places are going to be empty without them. They're going to be lost. But you can't give up. And so I studied them for 4 years before I went back to grad school. And things have really turned around for them because people did start coming out of the woodwork. And with the legislation we had to protect the critical habitat, which right now is, unfortunately, that legislation may be gutted, which to me is just the worst thing could happen in the world, because over 40 years, we have saved a species. We actually saved it. They've made a tremendous comeback. They're off the endangered species list. So it shows that with determination, there can be some real success stories. And I think what worries me now is our memory's short, at least mine is short term. And if we don't remember how it feels to be so close to losing a species as a magnificent or any species, we aren't going to put the effort to try to save them. So that's why I think that book really shows how critically close we came and how scientists working with the public and with the right legislation and banning DDT was successful. So two things there.
Yeah. I can't imagine. I mean, I can kind of imagine, but I also can't, you know, just being so close and being on the brink and like really intimately knowing the species, you know. It's like, I mean, we know of family members, you know, when they pass away, or friends who are really close, and it's a deep loss, and we care because we know and love them. And so I feel like if we could come to appreciate and really get to know and get to love these different species, maybe it would inspire more people. And I'm sure your book has done that. I'm eager to read it. So another question I have relates to One City's Wilderness, Portland's Forest Park. What have you learned about conserving land or protecting land during your process of writing that book?
Once again, several things that I think have been of value in my thinking. One was the park wasn't protected for 50 years. The Olmsted brothers, you probably realize from Forest or from Central Park fame, their sons, John and Robert Olmsted, made a 1903 report to the Park Bureau of Portland saying this land is important and this needs to be protected. And it wasn't. And they tried to develop it, but didn't happen. But there are always people that fought to try to get this preserved. So back almost 75 years ago now, it finally happened. So things may not happen right away, but people still kept trying. Okay, so, and it's been wonderfully managed by Portland Parks. But the thing I also know is even if something's protected, our job doesn't end, because those protections can get, you know, they just can be watered down, or things, people can come in and change them. A different political event might come in with Forest Park. There's a question, does it remain this amazing native wilderness, or should it turn into a Disneyland because it's got all this acreage? So part of that is getting people to appreciate what a native ecosystem is. And that's always been my goal for all my books, is how do you help develop an appreciation for these things and the people so they want to fight for them too.
And that's been a challenge, but kind of the ongoing challenge for UMC Watersheds, the organization that I'm serving, really trying to protect some of these old growth forests and native forests, not just for a single species, but the interconnectedness. Mm-hmm. You know, so many species that rely on them, and then including humans. You know, sometimes people don't remember, they just forget that, oh, right, you know, if we cut down all the trees, then that's going to impact our water quality, or that's going to change the way, like the amount of precipitation. Like there's so many things that are so interconnected. We need to be more aware. So yeah, I appreciate the way that your books are kind of educating and informing, but also hopefully inspiring people to take action.
We'll be right back after a few brief announcements. Do you love to read? Are you interested in meeting new people? Would you like to learn something new? If you answered yes to any or all of these questions, you should check out Turning Over a New Leaf, an environmentally themed book club, which meets every other month to discuss a book or topic. You can learn more on UMCWA Watershed's website or Facebook page, or by emailing our Director of Education and Outreach at ryan@umpquawatersheds.org. And now back to Living Downstream, brought to you by UMCWA Watersheds.
Let's see. So I was noticing, too, that you have a couple different books that focus on birds. What is your favorite subject matter, if you have one, or what do you most love to write about?
Gosh, I love writing about nature, but I also love writing about people and kind of human nature and how those two kind of intersect, and how the human condition, I think, really can benefit and needs what nature offers in terms of a sanctuary and tranquility and just for our well-being. So it's kind of like a parallel, but yet how do they intersect? I love birds, of course. That's my background, really, studying raptors, birds of prey. But you wouldn't have them or doing well unless you had the right ecosystems, and they have to be healthy and they're under challenges. And then I think I realized through my science is that people have to be, you have to think they're part of the equation. They are. These ecosystems don't live in a bubble anymore. And it's very important to see how do people interact in these systems. And so I like to write about that too.
Yeah, I was recently watching Seven Worlds, One Planet. I don't know if you've seen it. It's narrated by David Attenborough. But it talks about the different wild species that live on each of the different continents. And the most recent episode or show of that I watched had to do with Europe, which has been very much colonized by people, inhabited by people. And there are lots of different species that are living right on the edge. They showed they had these heat sensing camera, and they'd been looking all over like wolves, for example, and they realized they were living like right at the outskirts of the city. Like they weren't that far away at all. And then the, the rocks of Gibraltar. And there's like a certain type of monkey, the macaques, that are like only found there. And I don't know, it's just, yeah, these animals are living in such close proximity to humans. So humans really need to think about the impact they have on them, because they're kind of, yeah, in the same ecosystem at this point. We're living together with them. We're part of the ecosystem, and we need to make sure we're not acting like the only part.
Right. Absolutely.
So your newest book, A Generous Nature, Lives Transformed by Oregon. I recently ordered it. I haven't started reading it yet. It just came in, but I'm very excited to read it. So that's about conservationists. Why did you choose to focus on their work? Like, how did you figure out who to interview? What has people's response been?
Well, it's interesting because after I was doing all my wildlife work and writing, I sat on a board called the Oregon Parks Foundation, which is now part of the group called Oregon Community Foundation. And through the years, I was kind of the young kid on the block. I saw these older people and started hearing their stories and started learning that, you know, this person saved Tryon Creek and this person saved the Columbia River Gorge Scenic Area and this person. And I started realizing that I didn't know all these things I kind of took for granted, the places, the legislation, that we have 360 miles of public beaches. No other state has anything close to that. And how did that happen? And then I started realizing it took individuals and their determination for years to give me so much of what I loved about Oregon. But I also started realizing their stories weren't written down anywhere. You couldn't find them on the internet, maybe one or two, but most of them you would never know that it took this person meeting these tremendous odds to give us wonderful gifts that we now, you know, have around us in Oregon. And I thought, I've got to get these stories down. So got a little tape recorder for about 10 years, started going around Oregon and interviewing different people who had done so much. And what I started learning was, what was so cool was they came from every religion, every background. They were Republicans and Democrats. They were Native people. They were Muslims. They were Christians. They were, you know, it didn't matter. All those labels we put on people, because they wanted something more. They wanted to leave the world something good. And a lot of times, you know, what they tried to do didn't maybe pan out, didn't work, but they kept still going. So I wanted to get even deeper, not just their accomplishments, but their values. How, because a number of them have already passed away, you know, why would you do that? You didn't get any money for it. You didn't get any acclaim for it, for the most part. No one's, you know, when I say no one's going to remember what you did, and yet you did it, and you gave us such a gift. And hearing their wisdom for life. So all of that really touched me. And I thought, if we don't know what these people have done, you know, we're going to forget how we even have these treasures. So it became real important to me to kind of a race against time to get these stories.
Yeah, no, I've found too that just the process of interviewing people and getting to know them, like, you know, for me, for the radio show, I'm being able to interact with so many different people. And it's just such an honor and privilege to be able to hear from all of the people who have come before and you. But yeah, to just really get to know people through the interview process. So I imagine that was similar for you as well.
Mm-hmm. And one thing that was wonderful was that the people, I think, did appreciate it. It kind of makes them realize, at least some have died, now their families appreciate it. Like, their stories aren't going to be forgotten. These things are important. And they also are so inspirational. They're like a lesson in civics. The Oregon Community Foundation was lovely. They gave a $10,000 grant to put a book in every single library in Oregon. So that was really cool. And so I just was so pleased to be able to tell the stories and have them so pleased themselves and happy, and their families, knowing that what they did will not be forgotten.
That's so wonderful to hear too, that your work is being spread. Because you have mentioned this a couple of times, that you want people to learn about and appreciate, you know, someone or something, people, species, places, which I find really inspiring, because that's something I've been thinking about for my own books. But I always appreciate when authors do that, right? You know, try to connect with libraries, with schools, that kind of thing, to be able to share that wealth of information. You know, you're doing a lot of work to collect that information, yeah. And it needs to get out there. So that's just so great to hear. So speaking of A Generous Nature, our book club, Turning Over a New Leaf, will be discussing that book during our September 25th session. So if anyone's out there listening and might be interested, make sure you save the date, September 25th. And Marcy, you're going to actually be attending that date too, correct?
Absolutely.
So that'll be very exciting. I know, yeah, some of the readers that we've had who have attended previous sessions, you know, we had Robert Leo Heilman, and we've been trying to get some other local authors and sharing their books. So it's always exciting, whether it's a local author or not, but when the author is able to attend the book club session. So that'll be very exciting. And I was thinking too, just as you're describing these other books, Wings for My Flight, One City's Wilderness. It sounds like a lot of them would be good for our book club list. So we may end up reading others in the future as well.
Yes, they've been really wonderful books to write, and they have had some wonderful consequences, like Prairie Keepers. After that book came out, we worked with the Nature Conservancy, and now they have purchased, 40,000 acres of the Zumwalt Prairie. As a result of learning that information, and we still work together. And but what's really cool about that one, because they've brought in for the first time, the Nature Conservancy brought in the local people, brought in the local ranchers to help them with this management, which when I was studying Prairie Keepers, that would have been unheard of. You had ranchers and environmentalists and they could never meet. And yet, as I started realizing and learning, like, oh my gosh, you need them all to be a part of this, to get anything done and to preserve these things. So there've been some rewarding things that have happened since the books have come out.
Yeah. I imagine that must be so inspiring for you to know that you've had a hand in making some of these great changes and bringing people together, sharing that knowledge and information. Yeah. Kudos to you. So before we wrap up, what's the most important or significant thing that you've learned in your work as a wildlife biologist and or as an author?
Well, I've learned, I think, a lot of different things over the years and in time. And I think the main thing is, even if things look pessimistic, even if things look dark, like we've had a difficult time in the pandemic, even if we are so discouraged about the state of the world and the politics, that there is still awe and wonder in our world. And that's why I think it's very important to have opportunities to be close to and in touch with the natural world, because that does offer us strength and it offers us beauty that can transcend even the darkest moments, and I think, and well-being. And I also think I have learned the importance of never giving up. I think that a lot of that came from maybe perhaps, from studying the peregrine falcons and also from the people I interviewed and Generous Nature, because I started seeing that things didn't always turn out, and they don't always turn out the way we think they should or the way we hope, you know. And these people could have gotten super discouraged and say, I'm going to give up, but they didn't. And what I learned, I think, from that, there's something deeper and longer lasting than just achieving success, whether it's success in your project or success in your book or success in whatever you're doing. It's what's more important, and for the sake of humanity, and I think even for yourself, is not just to win, but is to try and just keep trying and keep trying. And I think our world is worth it. And we have other generations following us, and we just have to keep and the things that really have value and keep a positive attitude, even when you don't feel like it. And those people really did. And I was very inspired by that. So I keep trying to remind myself when I do get discouraged, and that you just keep plugging away, keep trying. It is worth it. Our world is worth it.
Yeah, that sounds like an excellent end note, place to leave. But I just will comment too that, you know, some of the other books that we've read through book club, you know, we read about Wangari Maathai in her book Unbowed. So she was a woman who, I don't know if you have heard of her, but she started the Green Belt Movement in Kenya, and which is now an international organization. And just, yeah, we recently discussed this book in book club, so I'm thinking about it a lot. But she's just one of my heroes, because, you know, she stood up against crazy odds. She was beaten a number of times, got put in jail, and she just kept going and, you know, involving local women to plant trees because the forests were being cut down. And just, yeah, thinking about like, okay, like she could have been like, oh, like this is like a riskier than I thought. I'm just going to stop. But it was so worth it. Like you said, it's so worth it. And, you know, if we just give up, like, I mean, it can be easy to get overwhelmed because there are a lot of problems. There are a lot of challenges, but if we can find a little niche and start working on that one, then we can make a difference. You know, if you hadn't written that book about the peregrine falcons, like who knows what would have happened, right? So we all can play a part. We all can do something, and we need to do something.
And I think being at this stage after these books I've written over time, and you know, they're all still in print and people still read them, and you realize the ups and downs of being a wildlife biologist or coming close to the brink of losing things you really care about. And we've lost 3 billion birds in the last 50 years, and things are still happening that are terribly, terribly sad. But when you work on these things, it's kind of like just meeting you right now. You meet people you like, you know, it isn't all sad and gloom. It's like, yep, there are times when it is, but there's also times you make wonderful friendships. And it's kind of like it's real meaning and purpose to life, which I think we all need, no matter what your age or what, you know, where you come from. It gives you that sense of purpose that can bring real satisfaction to life. And then the little triumphs, they're big deals. Every little triumph's a big deal. And I don't think you get out of this world without suffering. I hate to say it, you know, my other books talk about, one is called The Gift of Caring. Has to do with taking care of my parents and the healthcare system, which was failing them right and left. And yet being able to write about that and the response to that of people. And it's important. Just keep going. You meet wonderful people, you make new friends. And I just think there's something more to this life than just giving up. So.
Yeah. Is there anything else you'd like to share before we conclude the interview?
Well, I might read one little quote, which was the preface to Generous Nature. And this was about a man who was 85 years old. And when I would interview these people, it was so much fun because, you know, I just ask them questions on my tape recorder, but you could hear all of a sudden they'd say something, a quote. It's like, oh, yes, I love that. I love that idea. And so later I'd transcribe them all and then I could put them together. But I thought this one was really important by John Michael McCloskey. And he wrote, everything that has gotten done in the past is because somebody cared. They cared passionately, often devoting much of their life to it. New issues are emerging all the time. Attacks are being made to roll back the achievements of the past. It will be never ending, but it takes new generations succeeding the others to pick up the mantle and to carry the cause forward. It requires people who believe in themselves and understand that they can make a difference. Never underestimate the influence that an individual can have. So that just always inspires me.
Thank you so much for sharing that and for being on the show.
Oh, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
If you enjoyed Marcy's interview, you should join us for our next book club session. During the months of August and September, Umpqua Watershed's Turning Over a New Leaf book club is reading Marcy's book, A Generous Nature, Lives Transformed by Oregon, which we will then discuss during our virtual session on Saturday, September 25th, and the author herself will be joining us, so you won't want to miss it. Reach out to our Director of Education and Outreach by emailing ryan@umpquawatersheds.org to RSVP and receive the Zoom link for the event. We hope to see you then. Our second interview for today's episode is with Beverly Paulson, longtime member of the Friends of Crater Lake. Tell us, why did you join the Friends of Crater Lake?
Well, I joined in 1954, and I'm a charter member. My husband and I decided that this was a wonderful opportunity to be supportive of our only national park in the state of Oregon. And if we could learn more about it, and we could educate ourselves, and we could be good stewards of and be actively involved. So that is what we did. And it certainly is a wonderful way to get up to Crater Lake. I am amazed at the number of people, even in our area. I don't know the number, but I have heard that people say, you know, I've never been up to Crater Lake National Park, and it isn't that far from here. We have 300 members now of the Friends of Crater Lake National Park. That seems like a lot, but really not. Well, I know there are members from all over the state. There are members from all over the country, and there are even members from other countries. So here we are, not too far from Crater Lake, and we need more membership from our area, because one thing, it is good for the economy of our area. It's good for Klamath Falls, it's good for Bend, it's certainly good for Roseburg and other communities as well. Because people who come on a trip to Crater Lake also will, come down what used to be the beautiful North Umpqua, and someday it will be again, and come down to Roseburg and explore other areas.
I was thinking when you were talking about like the membership to Friends of Crater Lake, what does the money, like the membership dues, what does that money go towards?
Well, it goes to help support our projects. And bear in mind that membership is very inexpensive. If you are a senior, 55 or over, it's just $15 a year. And it does help support our various projects, which we'll be talking about later. And there are park pals. If you're 12 or under, it's $5. If you're a student, it's 15. So there, it's a variety of memberships. And if you're the kind would like to be a life member, it's $250. You pay that, and hopefully you have a long life, and you will be a lifetime member. And then another thing that goes along with it, if you're 65 and over, you can apply for a park pass, and that admits you without paying admission to a national park or state park. So there's a lot of benefits, and certainly if you want to pay, you're one person and $15 a year, you could just have a few lattes for that. But you would be a member of the Friends, and as a member, you get a wonderful newsletter. Their newsletter is exceptional. So not only tells about the activities going on, but activities that have gone on in the past, and a lot of information. And if you want to become involved, there are always phone numbers there of people to contact.
Very cool. I know on our previous episode that we did about Crater Lake, Bob Allen encouraged all members of the Watersheds and anyone listening to also become a member of the Friends of Crater Lake, because it is so inexpensive and it's supporting a good cause. And then, like you said, you get that great newsletter as well. So hopefully people will support this initiative.
Yeah, right. I hope so.
What's your favorite thing about being a member or being part of the Friends of Crater Lake?
Well, there are multiple benefits. I love going up to Crater Lake. It's beautiful, changes all the time. So you've seen it once, you haven't seen it forever, because it does change. And the blue of Crater Lake, you can't replicate with anything else. And it is serene. It is makes you, think, and gives you kind of a philosophical feeling. And it is very relaxing. And so, but it's not only looking at the lake itself. It is, there are opportunities to hike. And with the Friends, there, most of the time I have gone up to Crater Lake it's been for a board meeting, or it's been to help with something. And we'll be talking about some of those activities, I know. But it is a wonderful place. Something that was really interesting in observance of the centennial was a symphonic composition that was written, and the Brit Festival players came up to the rim and performed this original. And we even had some Klamath people came there with their drums, because it was, settled, visited by Native Americans first. And so the composition was wonderful. And I know I was a volunteer that day and just at an information desk. But it was a beautiful, original symphony. 130 classical musicians were there that day. The composition and the concert is available through PBS Passport, which provides on-demand access to public television, programs.
That's great. Yeah, I went to a nature center that did this thing called Orchestra in the Pines. And just having music and nature together, I don't know, it was a very neat experience to be able to literally sit in a forest and there's, this orchestra playing, sitting amongst the trees. So I imagine that was a very magical event also at Crater Lake.
That was magical. Yes, very magical.
What other types of activities have you done, whether at Crater Lake or with the friends?
Well, I was involved in many different ways. In August, the Friends always host a project weekend, and they didn't do that last year. Hopefully, they will do it this year. During project weekend, people come with, if they have a camper or RV or something, they stay for the weekend. And the projects, they range from, light work, I'd call it, or medium work or heavy work, because some of the volunteers have actually helped to build bridges that go over creeks. And that takes muscle. But it could be working on the trails, cleaning the trails, sometimes expanding the trails, because early on, this was not Project Weekend, but early on, they connected the rim with the Pacific Crest Trail. And so that was a major accomplishment. That was before I was involved. But Project Weekend, there's light work to medium to heavy work. And then when you're through, all the volunteers gather around the campfire and talk about what they've done and share a meal. And usually there's someone who's in charge of, preparing the meal. And if they have a vehicle and they want to camp it, they want to keep it down at Mazama Village, they can park there for free. And that's where I suppose money from membership comes in, because that's, privately run. And other things, we have had in the past an artist in residence program, and we invite artists to come there for not just a day, but I think it was almost a week, I'm not certain, but they could stay there, and the Friends provided the cost of housing, and so along with the park. And so then their work would be, if they did a number of art pieces, then there would be not maybe all of them, but a selection of them that would be put up in the community center. And then on a weekend, we would have a showing, an art showing. And people, you know, were visiting the park, really enjoyed seeing, you know, the artist interpretation of the area. So that was definitely one thing we did. And certainly trail maintenance is just not for project weekend, you know, that goes on too. And there are, there are other projects, for example, like Ride the Rim weekend. There are two weekends in September. The dates of that, September 11th and 18th. And I've checked and they're planning on that. That's going to be open. But there are no cars on the rim. And if you're a bicyclist, then you can ride the rim. It's 33 miles. And some people say, how long does it take? Well, you know, it's 7,000 elevation. You aren't going to do it in 33 minutes. It's how often you want to stop and look at the view from another aspect of the lake. And I've been around the rim, but not on foot or on wheels, but not bicycle wheels. And I wish I could do that, but I wouldn't be able to make it now. But it's people really enjoy that. And when the volunteers come in, there are probably three stops along the way, manned by volunteers who give out snacks and water. And they have a porta potty there also at these three different stops. And it's just a real feeling of satisfaction, I'm sure, to know that you have completed that 33-mile route at, you know, high elevation. And so pedaling may not always be easy and you may have to stop often, but it's something you can say you have accomplished, and you have captured many different views of the lake that you can bring back whenever you need a little solitude in your life. You can picture many different scenes. So I'm certain there are quite a few people who have done that. You know, in the past, Cycle Oregon has come up through Crater Lake too and has done that route. And volunteers have helped with that and have, I think, you know, they've provided more substantial food because they've already been bicycling quite a bit when they get there. And so that's been a fun thing to do too, and to meet some of these cyclists who, it's their passion to ride the bicycle wherever they go, and that's wonderful. So those are some things we've helped with. And during the centennial, you know, we helped with a lot of things. And I guess I would get back to what is my involvement. You know, there is a board for Crater Lake National Park. And I was vice president from starting in 2001, and then I became president. And I was president in 2002 during the centennial. And so by the members, we're very busy with that, because there were a lot of people coming up, and we, you know, and all of this is just not the friends. We work with the park and the staff at the park. So you have that opportunity to meet people, not only in the friends, but the park staff, and to work with them. And it is really a wonderful learning opportunity. And so together compiled, we contacted all of the list, and they did the contacting, but we helped with putting that together. So we had a directory of all past park employees in the first 100 years of the park. And there was a special play that was developed. And it was shown at the Douglas County Museum in Roseburg. At any rate, I'm sure if some are listening, they were there at the time to see this film, and it was called Crater Lake Into the Deep. It was a film that was produced for the celebration. And another thing that happens, it's only happened once during, it was going to be last year, and I don't know if it'll be this year, but we have had naturalization ceremonies up on the rim, and I was there to help with it, as well as Alice Lackey, who lives in Roseburg. And that was in 2013, and it's always in July, around the 4th. It was July 3rd. And so it was a beautiful, right on the rim. And it was, there were quite a few that became citizens that day. That was, you know, special for us and certainly special for them to be there and become a citizen at Crater Lake National Park. And another thing that we have, when you become a member, on the membership card, you can contribute to a Hartel fund. It's optional. Greg Hartel was not only a member of the Friends, but he was a staff member, and he was big into historic preservation. And any carpentry work that he did, he not only could see it, but he did it. And so in the buildings, if there was any remodeling or anything, he knew how to make it historically correct. And that was a real gift. And so at any rate, a fund has been set up. And that fund is used to bring students from the University of Oregon. If they're in the architecture department, where they have a strong interest in historic preservation, they come up during the summer and they have, you know, looked at all the buildings and determine, you know, which ones need a little more work or whatever. But it's a wonderful link with the university and Crater Lake to utilize, you know, college students and, you know, looking and assessing what kind of preservation may need to be done. So, and that's something that happens through the Friends, and that's where some of our money goes to help support that project. So the more volunteers we have, the more we can do. There's a science and learning center now, and we helped with some cleanup work that was once a residence, and it became known as a science and learning center, where anything related to science is done in a learning center. It's their classrooms. So, and there are times when there are schools that bring up, you know, elementary students or students from different groups and come up there for a class and a tour and involvement in some projects. I've never been there for when that has happened, but I think it's wonderful to get them involved, you know, at a young age. And trails, you know, there are always trails that need, you know, work. And so I think we've covered that. And there are a lot of projects that I have not listed here. So if you become a member, you learn about what's going on in Crater Lake and all the ways that you can help. It is such a special place and not too far away. So it's wonderful. And, you know, like some of the areas, the Watchman Tower and all, you know, people, volunteers have helped with that. And then when, you know, the lodge was built in 1915, and then at one point, you know, they decided that, you know, what are they going to do with it? And so they, instead of tearing it down and building something else, they restored it as best they could, and they did a wonderful job. And when we have the annual meeting, when the Friends have their annual meeting, we go and have lunch at the lodge, and that's always a treat. So I am really happy that it was restored. Oh, and there's a winter rim disc. So it isn't just nice weather that has a lot of events scheduled. In the winter, there's a winter rim disc. And there are people that come up and snowshoe, and there are snowshoe hikes and led by a ranger. And so that's a very popular thing for people to do. Always something going on. And being a board member of the Friends is certainly a learning experience. And it's just interesting to meet people. We even, when I was on the board, we even had a man from Chicago that, he was a rep for a big company, and he often flew into this area or other areas south of here also, but he was on the board, and that was really interesting. Yes, I thought, boy, good for him. Oh, we do have a relationship with other parks. We have an agreement with a park in National Park in China, and we have a agreement or sister city partnership with one in Europe, and it's called, I don't know if I pronounce this right, the Triglav National Park in Slovenia. And some members of the Friends of Crater Lake National Park have gone over to that, and a delegation from the park, National Park in Slovenia, have come here. So we aren't just local. We have a lot of connections with, you know, China, Slovenia, and I'm sure, as I said at the very beginning, that there are members from other countries too. So we do have members who are on the board. Paul Nolte is vice president on the board, and Larry Pelosi has been very active, and Mark Rochester, who I think lives in Sutherland, has been active. So I have noticed that was a Wayne Howe way back when I became involved and interested in 1993. And he was the one who encouraged me to join. So it's interesting how, there are a few people in this area who are really committed to Crater Lake. And if they, say, boy, why aren't you a member? And I don't know, I don't know every person in Roseburg who is a member. So, but if you know someone that is, boy, that's a good way to get involved, because they can invite you up. And I'd invite someone up, but at my age now, I only drive in town, and I don't even drive up to Crater Lake, although that's not a difficult drive. So do you have any questions for me?
Yeah, actually, so I thought of a number of questions when you were talking now. First, I would just comment that it sounds like there's an amazing variety of types of things. So bringing in artists, bringing in bicyclists, bringing in students. So that's just always great to hear when organizations are doing so many different types of things, because it attracts different types of people to all appreciate a natural area like Crater Lake. Yeah, another question I had, you mentioned about being on the board and some of the board members. So in addition to becoming a member of the Friends of Crater Lake, can the public become a board member? Or how would someone get involved or be on the board?
Yeah, well, all of the members of the board are members of the Friends. So that's because the board is for the Friends of Crater Lake National Park. So they do have to be members. Yes, and they come from, Klamath Falls and Medford and, Ashland and Bend and other places like Chicago, as I mentioned earlier, and, in Roseburg. And we've had, when I was on the board, we had a representative from Coos Bay. So that was good. And that's a little more of a trek to get to Crater Lake, but she never missed a meeting. The terms are 3 years.
Gotcha. I was thinking too, so you've mentioned different types of activities that Crater Lake offers or the Friends of Crater Lake offer. What other types of, just in general, like what other types of nature related activities do you enjoy or have you enjoyed?
Oh yeah, I've enjoyed hiking. And I now I like to walk in the neighborhood and in parks, and I am I go to the Y on a regular basis. But my activities are, when you're in your 90s, you aren't as active, but I still keep pretty active. Yeah. I was out pulling thistles yesterday.
Wow, that's impressive. Keeps you young, huh?
It's not exactly fun, though.
Yeah, I can imagine. Probably need to wear gloves or something.
But I've always loved music. I'm not a musician, but I am a good listener.
Awesome. Yeah, so I think my last question would just be, do you have any advice for people who want to protect Crater Lake specifically or who might want to protect other natural areas?
Well, I think it is very important to be willing to contribute in a positive way to the stewardship of our natural resources in whatever way we can. And if it's being an avid recycler, if it's part of working with, your group, and there are so many, the Audubon Society, there are so many different organizations. I think, well, that's it adds to you the quality of your life and the quality of your surroundings and environment. So I think it's important to do because we live on this earth and we need to protect it in whatever way we can. Well, it's been enjoyable.
Yeah, it's been great to have you on the show.
Well, thank you.